Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. From Wondery.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing good, Justin. How are you?
I'm okay. Not too many announcements. If any of you are in the Kansas City area in July, specifically July 11th and 12th, there is the True Crime Podcast Festival coming right here to our hometown. Go out to truecrimepodcastfestival.com, get your tickets, and use code GENWHY. That's GENWHY.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tonight's case, it's a crazy whodunit slash wrongful conviction type story. So with that, what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight, we're talking about the murders of Arlene and Seymour Tankliff. Their 17-year-old son was seen as the primary suspect in those killings.
It was September 7th, 1988, Long Island, New York. 17-year-old Marty Tankliff woke up for his first day of his senior year in high school. The house was unexpectedly quiet. He found his father clinging on to life, and then he went out and searched for his mother, found her dead. They both had been brutally bludgeoned and stabbed or slashed to death, and he immediately called police. So who were these people? Who were the Tankliffs?
A very wealthy family. Martin Tankliff had been adopted by Seymour and Arlene. Marty is 17, his mother Arlene, 53, and his father Seymour, 62 years old. His parents are fairly tall. His mother is 5'11", 190 pounds, and his dad is 6'2", 230. Seymour had an insurance business. They lived in a, you know, they call it an affluent community, but these are really nice big homes. I think they said in 1980, there were a little over 800 residents in Suffolk County in this community. Martin described it as he had everything he ever wanted. The family had a boat. They had multiple cars. They had a pool. And he got to help out his mom with cooking. He did his own work. He would go out and mow lawns or help the neighbors. He would make extra money. I guess it was sort of like the work ethic. And he also got involved in helping his father with his business. As time went on, his father decided he was going to retire. And so he sold off the business. He was very much a part of the community. He was actually the constable for his village. He would put money, because he had a lot of money, he would put it back into local businesses and things. In 1983, he met a guy by the name of Jerry Stewartman. He owned a chain of bagel stores known as Strathmore Bagels. And this is something that had been in his family for generations.
He referred to himself as the Bagel King of Long Island.
Seymour loved the bagels, and he decided to invest in Jerry's bagel stores. Well, they ended up in business together. Seymour would loan money to Jerry. These were high interest loans. One was to finance this nice home that Jerry Stewartman was building in Belterre. They also owned a racehorse. But because of these business dealings and because of the loans that Seymour was making, over time, Jerry started to owe more and more money to Seymour. But they were in business together.
And Jerry was very flamboyant and a risk taker and a high stakes gambler. So his debts would rack up pretty quick.
In 1988, Jerry Stewartman, he stopped making payments to his good friend Seymour. And this was causing some issues between the two men. I guess you could say because Seymour had loaned him so much money, he started to act like, hey, all this stuff that you think is yours, it's basically mine. Like, you owe me so much money. It's, what is it, hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Over $400,000.
Yeah, he's like, these stores, they're mine. This is where people, it's like you get into business with someone and it goes wrong. It can go really, really wrong. And I think you could say Seymour had been a very good businessman. He had taken care of his money. He had invested well. But then again, Jerry was the guy that was the king. He liked to show off and not so responsible. And so these two men ended up at odds with each other.
If you take that number, 400 something thousand dollars, in today's money, you can just double it. So that's almost $1 million he owed Seymour. Now, even after he racked up this debt, he and Seymour were still civil. They were still friends, quote unquote. They didn't fight outwardly, but there was always an elephant in the room.
It did reach sort of a breaking point, though, in a way, because in September, Seymour demanded an immediate payment of $50,000. I guess he's testing Jerry. Like, you need to pay me. But Jerry didn't seem to give in. He didn't seem to say, okay, I'll pay you. He didn't do that. Like you said, while there were issues there, Seymour still invited Jerry over for a poker game. Seymour would have these high-stakes poker games at his home, and prominent people would come over from the community. And he still invited Jerry over, despite Jerry owing him all this money.
That's just a bad combination there, because I know when somebody owes me money, or when somebody claims they don't have any money, and then I see them post on Instagram or Facebook that they're going on a vacation or that they're, you know, buying a new car, I think, why aren't you giving me that money you owe me? And to watch somebody gamble it away right in front of my face, it's just like kick in the face, you know, saying I don't care about what I owe you.
Justin, what do you think about this? Because obviously Jerry owes him lots of money, but Seymour, despite the $50,000 ask, isn't saying, all right, you can't come to poker because you still owe me too much money to be gambling.
It just tells me that Seymour is a inviting and generous person.
Maybe a softy?
Maybe. He's not a violent person, that's for sure.
Yeah, he definitely could have been a lot pushier about this. He could have contacted an attorney. He has the money to do that. But that's not how this goes. September 7th, 1988, 6 in the morning. Marty Tankliff, he's 17. It's his first day as a high school senior. He's getting up, and he notices pretty quickly that things are off. Things don't look right. Lights are still on. The alarm, the house alarm, is not set. And as he goes around and checks doors, it's not locked. This isn't normal. His house would normally be secured for the evening.
And his parents usually would be up at about the same time he was to get ready for work, get him ready for school, whatever their routine was. So this was very odd to him to find the house in this state.
Marty was walking around the house. He's looking around for his parents. He entered his father's office and found him on the floor, a bloody mess. He was unconscious, but he was still alive. Marty called 911 right away. And he said, my dad's bleeding from the neck. So, of course, they're instructing him on how to handle the situation as best they can. And he's trying to help secure his father. He's putting a towel around his neck and putting a pillow under his feet. It's about 6:10 a.m. He called his half-sister's home and told them his parents had been murdered. Now, the police and an ambulance arrive, and they rush Seymour to a hospital in Port Jefferson. Unfortunately, though, Arlene was found in the master bedroom. She had been murdered. And Marty had told the EMTs that showed up that he knew who had attacked his parents. Now, Justin, how many times did we say this? If you call for the police, you call for help, and assistance comes, and you're already trying to steer the investigation, how does that look?
It never looks good. And so you look at this affluent family, you have this teenager who might be mad at his parents. You have this teenager that might be in the know that they have huge life insurance policies. You have this teenager that might be impulsive and get an idea to wipe out his parents and collect on the inheritance. So he is already telling EMTs that my father's friend Jerry probably did this. And he doesn't seem very upset. He seems very matter of fact. And when the investigators show up, well, they notice his lackadaisical attitude.
Marty was not crying. He looked very calm. And Detective McCready, who showed up sometime after 7:30 in the morning, he said, the kid just didn't have any emotion, totally not understandable by me. When I approached him, the first thing out of his mouth was, I know who did it. Again, it's steering the investigation. It's saying, yeah, I know who did this. In other words, it wasn't me.
Now at around 8 a.m., Marty's godfather and the Tankless family attorney arrived at the home
to take Marty to the hospital where his father was being treated. Detective McCready showed up and intercepted the godfather and attorney and informed them that Marty was already on the way to the hospital.
Yeah, he was actually pretty close by being interviewed by other detectives.
The attorney and them make their way to the hospital to check on Seymour, but Marty is nowhere to be found. Marty told the detectives that he really wanted to go to the hospital to check on his father. They told him to come to the police headquarters first, and it's about a 30-minute drive away. Now, they said that they needed him for questioning to try to figure this out. And Marty is thinking, well, I'm going to go down there and tell him who did this. Tell him everything I know about this guy. So he agrees. Now, he was not told that he was under arrest. He was not read his Miranda rights. And anytime Marty asked if he could leave, he was told he could not. When Marty asked if he could see his attorney, the attorney that was on his way, the detectives told him no and never informed him of his right to counsel. Now, that's where the interrogation should have ended, as soon as he asked for an attorney or as soon as he asked to leave. But, of course, they're drilling him, and if you ask for an attorney and they don't give you one and then you keep talking, well, police and law enforcement are going to take that as, well, you're still here cooperating with us, so we don't care. Now, understand, Marty had just gotten out of bed and found this heinous scene in his house. So he's barefoot. He's wearing a sweatshirt and shorts. It's freezing cold in these interrogation rooms, and it's just the most uncomfortable experience you can ever have.
His godfather met with a detective and started to tell him about Jerry Stuerman. So it's not like Marty was the only one coming up with this theory or this idea that Seymour's business partner was involved in these murders and these attacks. It doesn't seem like the police are too interested in this idea.
No, because they have the son who was at the scene of the crime, the last person to see his parents alive. Who else do they need? He has motive. He's going to get all the money.
Whenever someone is involved in a murder and they don't want to be caught red-handed, what do, Justin? They take a shower, right?
Yeah.
They wash away the evidence. Well, Detective McCready was talking to Marty and said, you know, we think you're involved in this whole thing. And we actually ran a humidity test, and it showed that there was a shower taken in the house this morning, and you're the only one there.
So Marty's saying, I took a shower yesterday, and the investigators are saying, no, you took it this morning. Marty was brought up in a very strict household. And in this household, his parents, especially his father, impressed upon him that you always cooperate with police officers. Police officers never lie, and that you should always respect them. And Marty's thinking, well, why would you say I took a shower? I didn't. Like, I don't know. I don't understand this humidity test you're talking about. They also tell Marty that they found his hair in his mother's hand and that they've already sent it off for testing, and it's a match for him. This is mere hours after Marty's called 911. But they go on to say that, no, we know that you had something to do with this. And they even go on to say something that's totally outlandish. What was that, Aaron?
Outlandish? I don't know. It might seem outlandish to some, but if you're 17 and your parents have been attacked, one of them's already dead, the other one probably isn't going to make it, and the detective calls the hospital right in front of you, then gets off the phone and turns to you and says, you know, your dad, he's conscious again, and he's naming you as the attacker.
Marty knows what happened that night. Marty is trying to reconcile how or why his father would say this. It's either because it's true or he doesn't understand. So Marty's totally confused. He's been interrogated for hours. He's been told that they can prove that he took a shower that morning. His hair is found in his mother's dead hand, and that his father has named him as the perpetrator.
Well, he can't make sense of this, but the detective has a reason for that. He said, maybe you don't remember because you blacked out, meaning you did all this, but it's like lost time. You don't recall it, but you did it.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements, I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
So MacReady goes on to come up with a narrative for Marty.
Yeah, he helps him. He's like, okay, so you blacked out during this, but we know from this evidence that here's how it probably happened. So he's like, let's go through it, Marty. You did this, but you just don't remember. So let's talk through it. Marty, with the detective's help, is coming up with how it must have happened. I mean, what was the murder weapon? Well, it must have been a knife from their own kitchen. And what did he bludgeon them with? Well, it could have been a dumbbell from his own bedroom. And they said, well, the reason why we can't find any bloody clothing or blood on your shoes is because maybe you committed these attacks while you were in the nude. Then you just took a shower and it washed away all of the evidence. This turns out to be, Justin, because MacReady is writing all this down, it ends up coming out to 2.5 pages, which they label a confession. Here is Marty's own words stating how this all went down.
Marty was asked to sign off on this confession, sign on the dotted line. But Marty, at this point, is thinking, well, if I did do this and I don't remember, then I can't honestly say what happened because I was blacked out. And I don't think I did this, so he refuses to sign this confession.
I think he really starts to doubt this whole idea that he can talk about how it might have happened because his godfather, Myron, shows up and says, that's enough. So it's almost like he now has an ally there, and it allows him to get out of that situation he was in for hours, the interrogation and the grilling. And so I think that's how he's able to step back and go, wait a minute, I can't stand by this statement anymore. And so he tries to retract his confession. But of course, the police are like, oh, no, 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 no. We have too much here. And so they collect further evidence from Marty. That includes, you know, the typical fingernail scrapings, his blood, saliva, and even some of his hair. But of course, they claim they already have enough, but this is just standard procedure. Now, this poker game that happened the night before, you wonder what this would have to do with the crime. I mean, if Marty carried out the attacks and killed his mother and his father's nearly dead, then what does the poker game have to do with it? Well, it's part of the timeline. And so they talked to a man by the name of Vincent about this poker game. He talks about when people were there, and he said he got there about 7 in the evening. He said Arlene was in the living room, and she seemed happy when they were talking. Then he went back to where the poker game was going on, and he named off the other people that were there. Seymour. There was a guy named Joseph there, a guy named Frank, a guy named Bob, Al, Peter, and Jerry. He said he ended up leaving about midnight, and the rest of them left hours later. The last person who left was Jerry Stuerman at about 3 in the morning. This is, of course, because they talked to various people who were there. Now, he even added that while he was there, there wasn't any hostility going on. There were no arguments between Jerry and Seymour. Remember, they've already had two people tell them that Jerry and Seymour were having major issues, but all they know is that Jerry Stuerman was the last to leave and Vincent was the first to leave. But again, there's nothing to indicate that there would have been any violence between these men that night or that following morning.
Now, the investigators were collecting evidence at the scene. They discounted robbery because they found no evidence of a break-in or anything missing. McCree noticed a knife on the kitchen counter and dumbbells in Marty's room, which of course are what he is saying are the murder weapons. The knife on the kitchen counter even has some red substance on it. So they believe that this is the knife used to slit his father and mother's throats.
Now, the hair they collected, it was found on Arlene's body. They had no roots. The medical examiner who did Arlene's autopsy, she had been slashed and it opened up this gaping hole. She also had been bludgeoned. The kitchen knife didn't seem to match with the wounds on her body. So he said, as far as he could see, that whatever was used on her would have been much smaller, like a utility knife. Now, Seymour, he's not dead at this point, but the doctor who had treated him said that his throat was slashed almost completely around his neck, and that he also had a severe depressed skull fracture at the back of his skull. Now, they couldn't match these dumbbells or the knife to the crimes. This red residue that they found that was on the knife turned out to be watermelon juice.
So they essentially have Marty confessing to this murder using this knife and dumbbells as the murder weapons. But now they've excluded this knife and these dumbbells as the murder weapons. Got it. Okay. Just want to keep the score here.
Well, let's put it this way. Okay. As they went through the evidence, as it was collected and analyzed, it did not match to Marty at all. This whole idea that they had Marty just basically red-handed was just something that can happen in an interrogation. It's to get someone to confess, which they did get a confession out of Marty. There's two ways to look at it. Either law enforcement got him to talk and he confessed, case closed, or when they're looking at the evidence and it's not matching, they have a major problem. But Justin, I mean, if they've got a confession, does it matter if the evidence matches anymore?
No, he might have just got the details wrong and disposed of the murder weapons, right?
Yeah, why couldn't he have disposed of the murder weapons?
They could not tie Marty to the crime scene, except for the fact that he lived in the house. There was no injuries on his body to indicate that he had been in any kind of altercation. None of his hair, blood, or skin was found near or on his parents. There were no weapons in the home that matched the wounds on his parents. So other than his confession, there's nothing. And again, just because they get the narrative wrong doesn't mean that Marty didn't do this.
In September of 1988, Jerry Stuerman left New York and went to California. He had emptied out his bank accounts, and he named his girlfriend as a beneficiary on his life insurance policy.
Now, one of those bank accounts was a joint bank account with Seymour, and it had about $15,000 in it. So Jerry's taking money from Seymour and leaving town. No red flags, no bells ringing, nothing.
His own daughter reported him missing.
It's almost as if he was disappearing off the face of the earth and faking his own death.
October 6, 1988, Seymour Tankliff died. During that whole time, he never actually regained consciousness. The story that the police gave to Marty wasn't true.
You mean he was never injected with adrenaline and brought back to consciousness and named Marty as the actual perpetrator of the crime? Okay, got it.
Right, that's the story that they actually fed him. It wasn't true. But you would think this would be upsetting to people to find out that they would lie to Marty like this over and over and over again. But, I mean, for some precincts, this is how they do it, right?
They can lie to you.
Because, you know, what they'll say to you is, look, we put the pressure on. We've got to get the person to talk. And if they confess, well, they wouldn't confess if they were innocent.
Even a 17-year-old boy who was just woken from a slumber, nah, why would he confess to something he didn't do?
Of course, this just upgrades an attempted murder charge to murder. And so now Marty's looking at two murder charges. The day before the funeral, Marty is released on $1 million bond and $500,000 cash. Here's what I find interesting. You would think that there would be a number of family members who did suspect Marty was involved. They would think, you know, maybe he wanted his parents' money. It was known that he and his parents were having arguments. There was some tension. Why wouldn't they suspect him? But it turns out one family member, his half-sister, suspected him. The rest of the family were all united behind Marty, said, Marty is innocent. And so the police were like, interviewing these people, waste of time.
There's no point in investigating or questioning the family when they're on Marty's side. To add insult to injury, Marty has to attend his own mother's funeral in shackles.
Again, there are family members who were standing behind Marty, and they even had their own stories about Jerry Stuerman. They were well aware of the problems with Jerry, about all the money that he owed, and about how Seymour and Arlene were afraid of him. It kind of puts the whole poker thing, you know, that poker night, in a different light. Think of it this way. Maybe even though he was trying to get Jerry to pay him, the reason he invited Jerry over to be part of this poker night was to kind of placate him. You know, you don't want to piss him off too much because he might do something terrible. Isn't that another way to look at it?
Or he might just take off on you and then you never see the money. Whatever the outcome may be, yes, absolutely placate him. But the detectives, not only are they just looking at Marty because he was the only person in the house, but they also don't believe that Marty could have slept through these murders. How do you not hear your parents being brutalized? They just don't buy it.
Arlene's sister spoke about this in August of 1988. She said that Seymour had gone to collect money from Jerry Stuerman and that Jerry had become very combative and actually grabbed Seymour, took him off his feet, and pushed him across the counter. And he said, I'll cut your throat.
Again, why is this guy not a suspect in this murder? It's just, okay, got it.
Now, Marty's got an attorney, And his attorney did his best to try and, I guess, get rid of this false confession, as they put it. McCready and the other detectives, they very much believe they have the real story as told by Marty Tankleff.
Now let's pause on this for a second. Marty never signed the confession. And according to the police, he didn't have to. They dictated this from him, so why do they need him to sign off on it? Now, Aaron, go try to buy a car and don't sign the sales papers. See if they let you drive off the lot with it. Go buy a house and don't sign any of the documentation to actually purchase that house. See how binding that contract really is.
But this isn't a business deal. These are law enforcement officers who were there in the room with the suspect who had told them how it had gone down, what had happened.
Okay, well, next time you get pulled over and you get a speeding ticket, tell the officer you're not going to sign that ticket and just drive off. See how that goes for you. It is a binding contract, and he never signed it. Yet, this is just thrown out the window and used as an absolute confession that he gave. It's weird to me.
It's weird, but I think they're going off of, hey, we're law enforcement. We spoke with him. He ended up cracking. He ended up telling us how it went down. That should be good enough, right?
Well, then they should have recorded it. So this confession is allowed as evidence because this is going to trial. And of course, a young Jewish boy accused of murdering his rich parents. Well, this is going to be big news in Long Island.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
In spring of 1990, this trial begins, and the prosecution comes out very strongly. They come out with this unsigned confession, but a confession nonetheless, and they talk about how this plot unfolded, that Marty wanted his parents' money. He was done dealing with them. He wanted the money for himself. He could have his own life, and that he attacked his parents between 3 and 6 in the morning. He used a dumbbell to bludgeon them and then slice their throats and necks as if they were pieces of meat with a kitchen knife.
I always love when DAs and prosecutors invoke this very brutal imagery and claim that they're just pieces of meat and they let those things linger with a jury.
Well, because they're setting it up as this young man did it and he's treating his own parents like pieces of meat. So letting the jury know, this guy over here, bad, bad dude.
Yep.
No sympathy for this guy. Don't have any. And of course, they say he'd showered his nude body to get rid of all the blood and then simply got dressed. Now, they also, though, Justin, state that he simply wiped off the murder weapons.
Oh, yeah, because you can just do that and get rid of all traces of blood and evidence, right?
Apparently. They do address pretty early on that Jerry Stuerman was ruled out as a suspect. How do they do that?
Well, Jerry claimed that he fled the state because of mounting personal problems. And he told the jury, "The only mistake I made in my life is that I lived lavishly." Well, he should have been living deliciously, apparently. But the investigators think, well, he left at 3 and they were murdered after that fact. I mean, I don't know. I don't have a better explanation here of how they cleared him as a suspect.
There was this idea that MacReady and Jerry Stuerman were friends, but of course that was denied by MacReady. Now, the defense, their plan is to attack this whole story. They say that this whole confession, it was coerced, and that Marty is actually innocent. He loved his parents. Sure, they had problems, but he wouldn't kill them. He had everything he ever wanted. And he attempted to save his father's life. Remember, he brought him a towel and attempted to stem the blood and stayed right there with them until emergency personnel showed up.
But that's what you would do if you killed your parents and wanted to get away with it.
But the defense also says, hey, you know that whole inheritance thing? He doesn't get any money until after he's 25 years old. So killing them now, it's 8 years until he sees any real money. And as for the murder weapons, the dumbbell and the kitchen knife, you know, what, he wiped them off? No, they were tested. The only thing they found on that knife was watermelon juice.
And if it was wiped off, then they wouldn't have found watermelon juice on it. But this is all, you know, facts and evidence that no one cares about. They also bring up the fact that Marty is a tiny, skinny 17-year-old boy at the time. He had just turned 17, by the way. And his father, pretty big guy.
I think it was, what, 6'2 versus 5'8. But of course, they would argue, the prosecution would argue, if you're carrying a dumbbell and you hit someone with that, you could do a lot of damage.
Yeah. So the defense's arguments are sound, but when you're not presenting any other alternative theory, when you're not allowed to present any other suspects, all the jury has to go on is, well, they were murdered and he was the only one there. It's kind of like the Michael Peterson case or other cases. When they're not allowed to be driven or steered towards another suspect, all they have to do is consider the person that's being charged.
The defense goes on to say, Marty took 2 polygraph tests, passed them both. He's not involved. No evidence ties him to these crimes. This really comes down to the word of law enforcement. That's how I look at it with this supposed confession. Think of it this way. People can confess and just not sign it. You know, they won't sign that statement because maybe by the time they're done, they realize, wait a minute, I know I wanted the interrogation to end, but man, if I sign this, I mean, that's it for me. Maybe that's the real reason he didn't sign it. But then again, I mean, what do you have to tie into the scene? All you have is the prosecution saying he wanted the money. He was done with dealing with his parents, so he killed them early one morning after the poker night. June 28th, 1990, the jury had taken a week to deliberate the case, Justin, and that you could tell, you know, just looking at the trial, that Marty was really feeling the pressure. There was probably just a ton of anxiety weighing down on him. What did the jury find?
This is a long trial. He was found guilty. He will end up being sentenced to 2 consecutive life sentences, which is 25 years to life apiece. He'll be eligible for parole in 50 years, or essentially 2040. This is devastating news to him and his family.
Now, his family lost it in court. They were wailing. Marty, you could see him wince his eyes shut, and he was crying. That's how this went down. But that's only half the story, Justin.
Yeah, this is pretty much where the story begins, I think.
Well, that was part one of this 2-part case. Here's a sneak peek for episode 2 coming out next week.
So what happens during these appeals? Because they point out a lot of issues here, especially the denial of counsel. They also start attacking the evidence about the murder weapons and how it obviously wasn't the knife or the dumbbell. They also point out that the mother was in the bedroom and the father was in the other room, the study, I guess. And there's no blood between the two crime scenes. The narrative is that he was going back and forth killing his parents using these same items. But now you're looking at it and thinking, there might have been two people doing this, being that there were multiple murder weapons used and no blood trails between the two crime scenes. It's just a lot of evidence that they're trying to point out in this appeals process.
The appeals don't really go well for Marty. Looks like he loses 3-2 anytime it gets to an actual vote by the judges. You know, when they're ruling on this, he ends up with two judges in his favor each time. That's not going to do him much good. And by 2001, he's out of appeals. And he's also penniless, basically. So at this point, even though he came from a very wealthy family, he needs attorneys who will do pro bono work, who won't expect to get any money.
Then in 2001, Marty hears about a Long Island attorney named Bruce Barkett. This attorney has a polygraph administered to Marty, which he passes, and Marty has to give him a $5,000 fee to take on his case for the pro bono work. And this gets the ball rolling.
I think the most important thing, though, that comes out of contacting Barkett is that Barkett has a private investigator who works with him, Jay Saltpeter. And Jay Saltpeter is the kind of guy that can go and track down leads. And so he starts going through all the files and he finds an interesting statement from a woman by the name of Carlene Kovacs. Now, Carlene, on Easter Sunday in 1991, attended a family dinner in Suffolk County. And while she was there, she heard a man talking about being involved in the Tankliff murders. This man's name was Joseph Creedon, and he was boasting about being involved. He said he hid in some bushes before and after the attack and had been covered in blood. Thanks for listening to another episode of Generation Y. If you can, take a moment and review us on whatever you're listening to us on. If that's Apple Podcasts, CastBox, Stitcher, we'd love to have you leave us a review. Also, if you're looking to find out what we are up to, where we'll be this year, you know, that's kind of in question with the coronavirus, but if we're doing any traveling, meetups, any kind of events, check us out on Facebook, the Generation Y Podcast, or Twitter at Gen Y Pod, or even Instagram, Generation Y Podcast. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.